Couch Potatoes across the country, around the world, on the radio and on the internet. I'm Kevin Carr, and you're listening to Fat Guys at the Movies. On today's show, I'm going to be talking about the new films, the Aladdin live-action / CGI remake, Brightburn, and Booksmart. I'm also going to be talking about some news, the trailer park, and the home cinema roundup featuring How to Train Your Dragon, The Hidden World. But first, if you want to get in touch with me, you can email me at fatguys@themovies.com. You can leave me a voicemail at 740-205-6456. That's 740-205-6456. You can find me on the internet at fatguysatthemovies.com or facebook.com/fatguysatthemovies. Or if you want to reach out to me on Twitter, I'm at twitter.com/KevinCarr.
Good evening. I'm Ron Burgundy, and this is what's happening in your world tonight.
This is going to dovetail into a longer discussion, but this is more of the news elements, is the issue with Game of Thrones. Now, first of all, let me preface this by saying I've never watched Game of Thrones. And that's nothing against Game of Thrones. It's that I stopped getting any sort of premium movie service back when I started doing movie reviews and DVD reviews, because I got sent so many items and discs and Blu-rays and DVDs over the years, I just didn't have time to casually flip through HBO or Showtime or Cinemax. So I never had HBO to watch it. And by the time I realized it was becoming a phenomenon, I'd gotten past the Red Wedding, and I'm like, well, I know, like, everybody dies in that episode, so why even bother? And then the more I looked and heard about Game of Thrones, it seemed like every week it was just punishment for the viewers. It was just stories about awful things happening to awful people, and that seemed to be what George R.R. Martin's push was in the series, was to essentially punish his audience and make them feel bad. So I never got into it. And it's finally worked its way to the end. And so I can come to this with a completely clean conscience, because I have no skin in the game when it comes to Game of Thrones. A lot of people do, on all different sides of this, whether people like the first seasons or the last seasons, or whether they like the series end or not. Everybody has an opinion. I don't, because I don't watch it. But they had the series finale this past weekend, and it was like, what, something like 19 million people watched? A huge number. I think that dwarfed the last HBO finale that made so much viewership, and that was The Sopranos, which I think was like in the 13 millions. So it was a huge success for HBO. But there are a lot of people that are very, very upset with not just how the series ended, but even before that, with what was going on in the final seasons. And so this guy had put together this online petition to remake season 8. And say, start from scratch, get new writers, D&D, that's the two showrunners that they don't like. The fans are not liking their work on the last season. They say, let's get rid of them, get new showrunners, and redo the season. Do a do-over. And of course, that's an absurd thing to do. Scrap that $100 million season that we just did. Do a brand new one. But keep in mind, that's also not a bad idea. Wouldn't that be interesting? Think of all the TV series that have had crappy endings. Stuff like Dexter, and people were upset with Lost, and you had How I Met Your Mother was a big slap in the face to the viewership. Imagine if they just budgeted to have a couple do-over episodes. Wouldn't that be interesting? They could certainly get people to watch it. I imagine if they said, we're going to redo season 8 of Game of Thrones, they're going to get people to get a new subscription, because that's novelty. That would be interesting. Now, that may last as a novelty as long as the two-part movie series endings like Twilight and Harry Potter lasted, and it might kill a series like the Divergent series. But that's an interesting idea. I actually think that that's not something that's out of the realm of possibilities. It's not going to happen with Game of Thrones because everyone's contractually done. But it might be an interesting thing for another series to do later. But here's the thing that I find interesting. The thing that people are complaining about, the actual fans that are complaining about, is being misrepresented out there. People saying, oh, well, you're just butthurt because you didn't like the way it ended. No, the people that I've heard complain about season 8 of Game of Thrones, they're complaining about the writing. They're saying the writing's not as good. And I can get behind that. Like I said, I don't watch the series. I don't know if that's true. But apparently George R. R. Martin had written the full books of the first couple series, and the TV show overtook that. So they don't have the dense development that George R. R. Martin would have put into a book, and they're just going off of outlines, and then they have to do that themselves. Maybe this is the Peter principle. Maybe D&D rose to their own level of incompetence and realized we can't work from an outline. We got to work from dense source material. There's already a backlash. People are yelling and outraged at the people for being outraged about this. But here's the reality. This kind of fan response works. Star Trek got renewed for another season back in the 60s from a letter writing campaign. The Dark Phoenix X-Men movie that's coming out this summer is in response to fan backlash for X-Men 3 that kind of botched the Dark Phoenix storyline, which comes right out of the comic books. So don't think that just because fans are annoying you doesn't mean that they don't have a say. You'll save TV series. You know, you got like Brooklyn Nine-Nine. I just started watching the last season on Hulu. That's something that from fan response got moved to another network. Community moved to the Yahoo streaming service, which was kind of garbage, but Community got another season because of fan response, not because of casual viewership response. So let's not dismiss the fan series. Those are the people that keep shows alive. I'll talk more about this because this has a certain Star Wars implication later on, and that's another thing that's suffering from people having a backlash to fan response to things. You're listening to Fat Guys at the Movies with Kevin Carr. That sound means it's time to roll into the trailer park. The first one I want to look at is for Abominable, which is an animated film about a girl who finds an abominable snowman on her roof. Opens on September 27th.
There's a Yeti on my roof. Hey, boy.
Or girl.
I don't know where you came from.
Code Red!
He escaped.
I want my Yeti back!
Is that your home?
No way.
I will make sure you get home, back to your family.
Couple things about this movie. First of all, this is, I think, the third movie that's involved, like, Yeti or Bigfoot type. Because you had The Missing Link earlier this year, and you had Smallfoot, which came out last year. Which seems to be one of these things that happens now and then. You get multiple animated films about the same thing because either people move from job to job and the word gets out and Hollywood does copy itself. We saw that with Ants and A Bug Life. You saw that with Armageddon and Deep Impact back in the 90s. You'll see these multiple movies that come out. Now, what's interesting about this one looks kind of unique. First of all, it has an Asian cast. It takes place in China. I don't know if the cast is necessarily Chinese, but they're Asian. And it has a little Chinese girl as the main role. So this is one of those American films that's trying to be a little more diverse. But it also looks like it's trying to borrow a little bit from Studio Ghibli, or at least that Asian-influenced animation. So I'll be curious to see this one. I think it's going to be vastly different than Smallfoot. So it looks cute, but it also looks like it's got an awful lot of heart. The next one I want to talk about is Terminator Dark Fate. That trailer just dropped, and that opens on November 1st.
2 days ago, I had this nice, simple life, and now it's a nightmare.
Who are you?
My name is Sarah Connor. Never seen one like you before. Almost human.
I am human. Why do you care what happens to her?
Because I was her.
The biggest thing that worries me about this is they're touting the return of James Cameron as a producer. When they have to tout the return of somebody as a producer back into a series, that's like when they say, from the studio that brought you this movie. You're like, really? Then you're not going to say from the key grip that brought you Avengers Infinity War, something like that. No, they have to do it as the studio. It's when they do that that it feels like they're hedging on quality and just going for semantics. The movie itself looks interesting. I look forward to seeing the return of Linda Hamilton, but I get a real Terminator Salvation feel from this trailer. And I just hope that it doesn't get too heavy and drab. It's by the guy who did Deadpool as a director, but that doesn't mean it's going to be wisecracking Terminators the whole time. We'll see what happens in November. Anyways, that's it for the segment. I need to go to a break. When I come back, I'm going to be talking about Brightburn and Booksmart.
Booksmart.
And welcome back to Fat Guys at the Movies with Kevin Carr. Let's start off with the movie reviews and let's talk about Brightburn. A couple raise a baby who falls from the sky in a spaceship only to discover his dark turn once puberty starts.
I will never turn against our son.
He's not our son!
Something wrong?
Boy around by chance.
You're one of the only people in the world that knows how special I am.
Whatever you've done, I know there is good inside you.
I want to do good, Mom. I do.
This is an iconoclastic superhero movie because so many superhero movies are out there and you've got all the hero films and, you know, the Avengers finally kind of did that infinity arc that finished up this summer. And you've got Shazam and Aquaman that have continued the DC turn and course correction into successful movies. But this is the one that shows the darker side of superheroes. And it's not that we haven't had these before. We've had iconoclastic superhero movies. Why this movie works is because it's not made like a superhero movie. It's made like a horror film. That's really how it's put together. And that's the audience it's going for. And I had to go see this in a Thursday night preview. And I'm sitting in the theater looking at the people in the theater, and it looked much more like the crowd that went to go see Pet Sematary than the crowd that went and saw Shazam at the same theater. It certainly fits that horror movie bill, and it's violent and it's R-rated, and it's disturbing at times. There's a couple problems, and not necessarily some of these problems aren't necessarily with the film. It's that in order to know what the movie's about, you got to get past the premise, and the premise being, this is essentially the Superman story. This is Superman crash lands as a baby, and Ma and Pa Kent get him out and raise him as their own child. But Ma and Pa Kent were good parents. Jonathan and Martha Kent understood how to make decent people. They raised Clark Kent properly. They gave him a good sense of morals, and that allowed him to turn into Superman, turn into the savior of the Earth, essentially. It's essentially the original Superman story is a Christ analogy of child falling from Earth from a father in the sky to give it to save a planet. That's kind of how Superman got his start. Ironically, the guys who created Superman were Jewish, but it is a Christ story when you look at how it's been set up and how it's lived over the years. The setup of Brightburn's the same thing. The only thing is these aren't great parents. They're what would be average parents. There's a real problem with parents, and this has been the way it's been for years. This is not something where I'm like, oh, these stupid younger parents are... No, parents have always done stupid things over the years, and it's just you don't get to share them on social media until this century. But these are the parents that allow their kids to get away with doing bad things, or they don't relate to their kids. And there's a scene in this movie where the father inadvertently gives permission for this kid to act inappropriately. He's in an awkward conversation, and the way he sets things up puts the seed in this kid's head to do something that's not good. And I thought there's a lot of truth in that, because I think a good chunk of bad parenting comes from parents who mean well, but they don't realize the consequences of their own actions, either by forgiving the kids from doing things. Like, there's a scene where the kid's mad and he breaks a kid's hand. And they're like, they almost are like, oh, well, it's, you know, boys will be boys. It was an accident. It's not an accident to deliberately break somebody's hand. That's a horrifying thing. And that does cause a problem. But there are too many people out there who have a kid who misbehaves, and sometimes misbehaves in a violent way and an aggressive way and in a premeditated, damaging way. And the parents are like, oh, but they're just so sweet. You just don't know my baby the way I do. And I think that's kind of the underlying tone of this movie, is the only thing that keeps some people straight is the fact that they can be hurt and damaged and can get beat up in a fight. But you take that fear away from a kid and you excuse a kid's bad behavior, you know, kids are still going to lash out. And if they don't respect you, or you inadvertently give them permission to act bad and then don't recognize when they're doing things that are malicious, and you excuse their bad behavior, that's when things are bad. So I think that there's a certain amount of value to be taken away from this movie from that, as an allegory to parenting. Now, of course, it goes completely off the rails. But, you know, hopefully most people who have bad kids and are bad parents don't create a monster. But people do. People do. They're some of the nicest people in the world have raised some of the most horrible people. There are people who are the nicest people in the world, and they may have the greatest intentions, and they may want to try and save the world, but they may raise an axe murderer. That stuff really happens in real life. And that's, I think, where the value of Brightburn comes from, as an allegory to parenting. Now, as a sci-fi horror flick, it works. The problem is, like I said, once you get to that premise, there's nothing more. You're just like, oh, I just have to let it play out as, you know, it's sort of like, you know, when you look at Halloween as a stalker slasher movie, if you don't want to build it up as there's some sort of mystery behind Michael Myers because he's just a psychopath who's killing people, and then it's just more fun to watch the cat and mouse game. And that's what ends up happening in this one. I just was expecting there to be something more, which we never got. And I guess that's because this is essentially an origin movie. But, you know, actually for origin films of supervillains, I think this is better than even something like Unbreakable. So ultimately, I'm going to say it kind of rocks because I think on a second viewing, knowing what I'm in for, I think it'll play better in my head.
It kind of rocks.
You're listening to Fat Guys at the Movies with Kevin Carr. Let's talk about the next film, which is Booksmart. Two girls who always behaved in high school cut loose for a night of wild partying.
Ow! It's the last day.
We got you through high school. That should do it, right?
We will persist.
We have to go to a party tonight.
What?
Nobody knows that we are fun. We didn't party because we wanted to focus on school and get into good colleges.
And it worked.
But the irresponsible people who partied also got into those colleges. We haven't done anything. We haven't broken any rules.
Name one person whose life was so much better because they broke a couple of rules.
Picasso.
He broke art rules.
Rosa Parks.
This is a film that did very well in the festival circuit. It's gotten a lot of accolades. They screened it in my local market multiple times, never invited press. That cheeses me off. It's already getting good buzz, but there's some sort of insane block in local publicists that say, well, we can't let the local press see it too early. Even though it's been at festivals and there are plenty of reviews about it, they don't want to show it to us. So I never got a chance to see it, and so the heck with them. I'm not really going to review it. I can't, and it's not worth it because you showed it plenty of times. I know because I've talked to some of the people who went to the screening. You just never invited press, which is insane, especially for a movie that gets good buzz. I don't know. This movie looks like it's trying to be the female Superbad, and that's fine, but there's this weird gender political thing going on where in Superbad, they're idiots. They're kind of dopes and dorks that fell into this night of craziness. Whereas this one's trying to be like, girls can be edgy too. It sort of like reminds me of Neighbors too, where they're like, it's okay for girls to be the hero and have sex with everybody and then take a bunch of drugs. And that's awesome because girls can be debauchery too. It's like, yeah, but when they do it with guys in a movie like even Neighbors, they're kind of sleazy characters that are doing this. It's not a one-to-one comparison. This is Olivia Wilde's directorial debut. I don't care. She's pretty and she's not a bad actress, but I don't care that it's her debut. I might check this out, but at this point, it gets a preemptive suck. Sorry.
It sucks.
That's it for this segment. I need to go. And when I come back, I'm going to be talking about Aladdin.
Shake that.
Welcome back to Fat Guys at the Movies with Kevin Carr. Let's talk about the big movie that's going to be the one this week that's probably going to win. I imagine it's going to win. Look, if it doesn't win this weekend, it is a bad sign. But I think it's still going to be a hit. Let's talk about the new Aladdin. In this live-action CGI remake of the 1992 animated film, Will Smith plays a genie who gives a young street rat a chance to be a prince.
Watch this.
Watch out! You done wound me up! You ain't never had a friend like me!
Hey, can you make me a prince?
There is a lot of gray area in Make Me a Prince.
You look like a prince on the outside, but I didn't change anything on the inside.
When this was first announced, people raised an eyebrow and cocked their head at the fact that, how are you going to do the genie? How do you replace Robin Williams? And that's a good question, because of all the iconic screen characters in cinema history, I would say you're probably in the top 10 or 20 with the genie from Aladdin. It was such a unique version of this character in the 1992 film. And then when they made a direct-to-video sequel, and they got Don Castellaneta, who does the voice of Homer Simpson, to play the genie. And he was fine for just what he was doing, but he wasn't Robin Williams. And there was such a backlash to the direct-to-video sequel of The Return of Jafar that they decided to make another one, The King of Thieves, and they actually got Robin Williams back to do the genie. It's very hard to do anything with the Aladdin genie without having Robin Williams. And of course, Robin Williams is no longer with us. It was an uphill battle for Will Smith. I mean, because they got Will Smith and they said, oh, he's a big box office name. He makes money around the world. Let's put a big deal. Oh, he should be able to do it. No matter what he did, if he does a terrible job, he's trampling on a legend. If he does a good job of doing his own thing, he's not doing what is truthful to the story and the character. And if he does the version of the genie that Robin Williams did, he'd be considered derivative. This was a no-win situation for Will Smith. With that said, he does about as well as I expected him to do. I don't think he could have done any better at this. That doesn't mean that it's a great performance, but at the very least, he doesn't completely fall on his face. But it's still not Robin Williams. And actually, the best parts with the genie are the more intimate, honest moments where he and Aladdin are having a conversation. But with Will Smith, there comes certain baggage. One of the things is you get Will Smith's ego with Will Smith, which means Will Smith needs to be in as much of the movie as he possibly can. If you watch the original Aladdin, the genie's in it for a handful of scenes, and then he's like in the background. Or not there at all. He's back in the lamp in a good chunk of the movie. It's Aladdin's movie. This isn't Aladdin's movie. This is the genie's movie. Make no mistake. The genie's pervasive throughout this film, even in places you don't expect him to be. On top of it, Will Smith fancies himself more of a comedic actor than he really is. He has, sure, history with a sitcom, and he's done comedies before, but his sort of Will Smith Fresh Prince swagger, he still tries to do that and put that in performances in movies like I, Robot. If you remember, one of the worst scenes in I, Robot is the scene where he's trying to do this witty banter with Bruce Greenwood. Sugar? Oh, no, I'm saying, do I want sugar in my coffee? Not funny at all. In fact, it's sort of cringeworthy. And they have a bunch of those scenes in this where they've inserted him more into this film, and to the point that they actually give him a love interest. They really needed to dial back on the Will Smith. The other thing is the character's way too aware. There's a bit, and I'm not going to give away because, you know, you may not have seen Aladdin and you don't know how things end, but there's a part that's a reveal that in the original movie, the genie doesn't quite realize what's happening. And in this one, the genie realizes way too early and plays it to the point that there's no surprise to the audience and it doesn't work. I chalk that up to Will Smith's ego because he wants to be the smartest, the best, the coolest. There's a couple scenes that are really genuine and good, but still, it's still kind of a Will Smith version of the genie, and he wasn't born to play the genie. There are other problems with this film. It's 38 minutes longer than the original movie, which is a problem. Part of the reason it's 38 minutes longer is they add some scenes and they add some, most of it's with Jasmine, but it's weird because they both underdevelop her character and overdevelop her character. Now in the original, Jasmine doesn't show up for like 10 or 15 minutes. In this one, she opens up in the first scene, but for the same way. So it's really confusing. It seems really rushed for Jasmine and Aladdin to meet, where it seems much more natural in the original. They get weirdly progressive in this movie. There's a scene in the cartoon where Aladdin leaps into a window and he ends up in a harem and he has to escape when he's running from the guards. And in this one, he leaps in there and it's a girl's school. And I'm like, are we still in 18th century Persia? Because now you're just getting absurd at this point. And then, like, there's this whole subplot in the original. It's her, she needs to marry a prince. And in this one, I'm going to marry a prince, but I should be Sultan. Why can't I be Sultan? And I'm like, this is kind of unnecessary. I get the whole thing that they wanted to scrap the whole, well, you need to marry a prince, and it's all because of the men. But again, you're in 18th century Persia. That's what happened back then. I don't mind progressiveness, as long as it's not at the expense of the way history actually worked. I mean, it's a little bit absurd, and it's not like it was really damaging in the beginning. So they have this extra song with Jasmine that she's great in, and she does a great job singing. But the problem is the song clashes with all the other elements to the movie. It sounds like it was plucked out of a Radio Disney pop lineup from 2019 rather than from Alan Menken's and Howard Ashman's music from the 1992 version. It's out of place. It's sort of like when they made that movie Annie remake with Jamie Foxx, and they gave him, Daddy Warbucks, a couple extra songs, and they just sounded like hip-hop garbage and had no bearing or connective tissue to the original Broadway tunes. They didn't even try. And that's part of the problem with this film, is it doesn't. And then there's scenes that go too big, and there's when they shouldn't, and then scenes that go too small. And as much as the CGI is there, it can be colorful and vibrant. And yeah, the introduction of Prince Ali, that's a great colorful scene. But even just Agrabah is kind of muted and not as vibrant as it was in the original. There's nothing in this movie that makes it better than the original. And there's a lot in this movie that you find yourself going, like Jafar. Jafar's terrible in this film. The movie's only as good as your villain. And Jafar is supposed to be the intense, mean villain who's very dry, but very pointed. I mean, Jafar in the original Aladdin is fantastic. In this one, they could have gotten Charlie Day to play him. In fact, he kind of looks like him. And there's a scene where Jafar's sitting there talking to Aladdin. He's like, back in my day when I was your age, and I kept waiting for Aladdin to look at him and be like, fool, I went to high school with you. There was something really sinister and brilliant about Jafar. I mean, if you look at Jafar and like Scar from The Lion King, those are two brilliantly done villains. And they worked as in the tradition of Maleficent. Both of them worked. And this guy, Jafar, just doesn't come across as threatening. He doesn't come across as intimidating. He doesn't come across as having any sort of real strength. It's just sort of blah. And there's a couple, like the escape from the cave of dreams or whatever it is, where they find the lamp. That's pretty cool. And that's equal to, I would say, the original movie. But even the cave itself, that comes out in the movie original one, it comes out of the sand and it's like, and you're like, oh, that's really cool. This one, it's just a cave that's eyes light up. And you're like, really? Here's where you could have gone bigger. Here's where you could have gone more fantastic and you decided not to. Yet you had to have this whole big action scene at the end that doesn't exist in the original movie just because it's a Guy Ritchie movie and you have the CGI to do it. Overall, this movie's okay. It's fine. I would say you go see it, especially if you've never seen the original Aladdin. You can go see this and enjoy it and have it be sweet and a good, fun family film. It's not a bad movie. But I felt like watching this as I felt when I watched the Beauty and the Beast remake. It just made me want to watch the original Aladdin again. And I did. I went back and watched it, and I'm like, no, that's a way better movie. But still, Aladdin's okay. So I'm going to be nice. I'm going to barely give it a kind of rocks.
It kind of rocks.
That's it for this segment. I need to go to a break. When I come back, I'm going to be talking about fandom backlash and why it's important to Star Wars, the box office, and the home cinema roundup featuring How to Train Your Dragon, The Hidden World. Welcome back to Fat Guys at the Movies with Kevin Carr. I'm not going to be reviewing another movie in this beginning of the segment. In fact, I'm going to continue a discussion I was talking about from the news segment, which dovetails out of the Game of Thrones fanboy discussion. And I'm done talking about Game of Thrones, but it's important that the two guys, D&D, who ran Game of Thrones, are now tapped to do some Star Wars work. And I think that that's important because, like I said, the complaint about the Game of Thrones season 8 from the fans, as best I understand it, isn't that they're upset that this person died or that person won. They're more upset with how they got there. They're more upset with bad writing that either messed up continuity from before or didn't take into account foreshadowing that had happened before or stuff that just wasn't handled with the finesse or depth of character that had been done in earlier seasons. And that's important because what they were working off of did change from fully written and realized novels to outlines. I've worked long enough in writing and publishing and watching movies and reading books. When I worked in textbooks, there are some people I knew who were great writers that could write stuff really well, but they weren't very good at editing their work or other people's work. And then I knew people who were great editors who could take something that existed and edit it and change it and tweak it and sometimes rewrite whole sections of it, but they were really not good at conjuring it out of the ether. Writing from scratch. There are great editors out there and rewriters who can take an existing piece of work and improve upon it and do a fantastic job. But coming up with something from scratch, that's a different animal. And it seems that this may be what's happening with these guys. And for everybody out there, there's been a lot of talk of toxic fanboyism and fans that are upset and they need to deal with it. Here's my response to somebody who dismisses the fans of any work, really. But let's talk specifically Star Wars. Where were you in the 80s, the late 80s and the early 90s when there was no Star Wars fandom in the mainstream? Where were you when Star Wars fans were considered dorks and geeks and the only option for them were role-playing games and comic books and stuff like that? Where were you, these people who dress and cosplay now? Where were you then? Yeah, I know some of you weren't born. But don't come to me in your 40s and be like, I love Star Wars. And I'm like, dude, I remember you in high school. You beat up people who like Star Wars. It reminds me of what happened with Doctor Who. Doctor Who was on the BBC for decades. And then it went away in the late 80s and they had a TV movie at one point. But then they came back in 2005 with Christopher Eccleston. And then they had David Tennant and Matt Smith. I remember this was right around the end of Matt Smith's run at the 50th anniversary. And there are all these people, who's your favorite doctor? My favorite doctor. I like David Tennant. I like Matt Smith. Big debate of all these people talking about it. I'm like, come on, man. I'm old school. My favorite was Tom Baker. For all you people out there who are fans of Doctor Who, where were you during the BBC years where stuff was shot on a shoestring budget? If you're watching stuff on the BBC America or you're getting DVDs to look at or you're streaming it off of Netflix or Amazon, are you watching the old episodes from the 70s or even the 60s? If you're not, then you're really not a true fan. Fans drive series. Fans are loyal, but the mainstream audience is fleeting. And this is something that Marvel's figured out. They get the mainstream audience, but they're true to the fans. Don't come to me and say, I love Marvel. If you've never cracked open a comic book and read it, and read Stan Lee's Corner and seen the words Excelsior printed in newsprint, don't talk to me about how much you're a big Marvel fan and how you've always been a Marvel fan if you've never picked up one of the comic books and read them. That's not a real fan. And that's okay. You can still love Marvel movies, but don't count yourself as an old school fan. Fans drive the series and fans keep it alive in the doldrums. Look at the effect that The Last Jedi had on Solo. Now, I know everyone's saying, oh, well, Solo had all these problems. And yeah, it did. It had too big of a budget and it wasn't a necessary movie. But I think part of the reason that Solo suffered at the box office was because The Last Jedi cheesed off a lot of the hardcore Star Wars fans. And with good reason. There's terrible military strategy in that movie. General Holdo, Laura Dern's character, was awful. She didn't tell her people what she was doing. She worked like an egomaniacal tyrant. She gets in the ship and then goes light speed into the Star Destroyer. Like, no one's ever tried that before in the Star Wars universe. And it's exactly the same behavior that Rose Tycho stopped Finn from doing on the planet's surface when he was going to kamikaze into Kylo Ren's juggernaut. And speaking of Rose Tycho, she's not a good character. Oh, yo, she's the heart and soul of Star Wars. No, she's not. She abandoned slave children to let farm animals out. This is not good decision making. The worst thing about The Last Jedi is it trampled and dumped on the stuff that was the heroism of the first three movies. It's sort of like at the beginning of Alien 3 when David Fincher directed that. Oh, David Fincher, you can't touch him. He's film royalty. But he kills Hicks and Newt at the beginning of Alien 3. And you're like, well, what was the whole point of rooting for him at the end of Alien? You just undid everything that Ripley went through to get that, just so you could get that emotional gut punch to start your terrible movie with. And the other thing, like Solo, here's another one. Solo, I think Solo would have done better if they just made the Star Wars movie. But yeah, somehow, and this I think kind of emerged during the press junket, because there's all these people like, oh, we need to talk about everything. We need to have every single social justice and every element of society represented. And they had to, somehow, when Solo was coming out, there was this big discussion of, is Lando a pansexual? Because he was clearly in love with his droid. And they make him kind of silly and whimsical and how much he loved that droid. But the point is, nobody wants to go see a movie about Lando the pansexual. They want to just go see a movie about Lando. You know, why was that even important? And I know that that permeated the culture and that permeated the narrative of that. And it was pushed by film Twitter. And then I'm getting asked on the radio about what's the stupid sexual thing with Lando. I go, I don't know. Just go see the movie. It's fun. But then you end up getting a bunch of the fans are like, I don't care about Lando and his sexual escapades. I just want to see the adventure. And then you have other people, their parents are like, I'm not going to take my 5-year-old if I got to explain to him why this guy's having sex with a droid, which is what I read on the internet. And they're course correcting with J.J. Abrams. And they got to watch out with these Game of Thrones guys. If they start doing stuff, if they want to do it in their own little pocket of the universe, that's fine. But let's not trample on what the fans like, because if you lose the fans, you lose the franchise, because the mainstream audience is fickle and it'll turn away from it. It's fad when it comes to mainstream fans. Even though it comes from fanatic fans, live and they keep a franchise alive. You're listening to Fat Guys at the Movies with Kevin Carr. Let's talk a little bit about the box office really quick. John Wick did actually exceptionally well last weekend. It did better than I think anyone was really expecting, so it toppled The Avengers, which is no get off the Avengers. The Avengers made almost $30 million last week. But $57 million for John Wick Chapter 3, that was its opening weekend. I believe, if I'm not mistaken, that's more than the first John Wick made in its entirety in theaters. That's more than half of what John Wick 2 made in theaters. So this is a franchise that's building. There's totally going to be a John Wick 4. And then, of course, the Avengers did pretty well. And this weekend, you're going to have Aladdin top the box office. We just got to watch that, because it just depends on how much it tops the box office may affect the course correction in these Disney remakes. They might sort of pump the brakes in some way. You're listening to Fat Guys at the Movies with Kevin Carr. That sound means it's time to roll into the home cinema roundup. Really quick, the one I want to talk about is How to Train Your Dragon, The Hidden World, which is hitting Blu-ray and DVD this week. As the citizens of Burke look for a new home, Toothless the Dragon falls in love with another Night Fury.
Where the good old days.
There is an armada with enough cages for all of our dragons.
They repeat her.
This is a new kind of enemy. We need to find the hidden world.
I will destroy everything you love.
Toothless, no!
You see, neighbor.
You're nothing without your dragon.
If Grimmel succeeds, there won't be any dragons left. And it's up to us to put an end to it.
I'm running out of time here. I'm up against the clock, so I'm going to quickly burn through this. I actually like the later How to Train Your Dragon movies. The first one's, I think, the weakest one. I really like the second one. I thought this one was good, not as good as the second one. But it's still a fun movie, and it's beautifully rendered, not shot, but it's beautifully rendered. The Blu-ray also comes, it's loaded with special features. There's like an alternative opening and some shorts, deleted scenes. And then there's a whole bunch of behind the scenes things about the design and how they did the dragons. And then, of course, a feature commentary. So there's actually a really good slate of Blu-ray special features, which makes it worth getting the actual disc this time. I know everyone's like, oh, it's all about streaming. No, this one's a good physical media to pick up. So I'm going to have to say that How to Train Your Dragon, The Hidden World, the Blu-ray totally rocks.
It rocks.
Excellent!
Other releases this week include Isn't It Romantic, The Upside, and a collector's edition of Earthquake. And that's it for this week. I need to go. Next week, I'm going to be talking about Godzilla, King of the Monsters, Rocket Man, and Ma. Until then, have a fat time at the movies.